Hello, and welcome to Pod Emperor of Dune. I'm Elaine, a longtime sci-fi fantasy fan, reading Frank Herbert's classic science fiction Dune Saga for the very first time. I'm joined by my co-host Alex, who is tackling his first reread. Join our chapter-by-chapter deep dive into the series, as I make wildly incorrect predictions, Alex tries not to give anything away, and together, we learn to walk without rhythm.
Hello everyone, welcome back to Pod Emperor of Dune. I'm Alex here as always with Elaine.
Hey guys.
Today we're diving into four chapters. We're going to cover 38 through 41 of God Emperor of Dune. So we're going to start off with Duncan as he has a conversation with Mineo and then Hui. Then in the second chapter, Mineo and Leto. Then in the third, Siona's testing begins. So we have her and Leto out in the Sarir. And then finally we wrap it up with Duncan and Mineo again.
Yes. I do think that you are maybe burying the lead by referring to the conversation between Duncan and Hui, but we'll get there.
Well, conversations take many forms. All right, so to start, our first epigraph from the Stolen Journals. You know the myth of the Great Spice Hoard? Yes, I know about that story too. A majordomo brought it to me one day to amuse me. The story says there is a hoard of melange, a gigantic hoard, big as a great mountain. The hoard is concealed in the depths of a distant planet. It is not Arrakis, that planet. It is not Dune. The spice was hidden there long ago, even before the First Empire and the Spacing Guild. The story says Paul Muad'Dib went there and lives yet beside the hoard, kept alive by it, waiting. The majordomo did not understand why the story disturbed me.
I don't understand either, unless it's just that Leto is disturbed at the idea that people believe Paul is out there somewhere. I don't know why the myth of a spice hoard would be particularly disturbing. Also, I do have to say, it's kind of a hilarious image that there's just this, like, giant pile of spice somewhere, and Paul just, like, sits next to it, just chilling.
Yeah, just guarding it. Yeah, I guess I'm sort of on the same track as you, but I guess the only thing I can think of that would potentially disturb him about it is maybe he's sort of aligning this to something beyond his prescience and what he's seen in terms of the Golden Path and what he has laid forth for humanity that he just has no control over.
Yeah, but it's obviously not real.
Yeah.
Especially since it, like, allegedly predates all of the Spacing Guild or whatever.
Right, I don't mean literally a pile of melange, like, out on another planet is necessarily real. I'm just saying, like, that concept of something like that that could subvert your plans that you haven't considered, maybe, is something that's nagging at the back of his mind.
Maybe he's just concerned people spend time looking for such a thing when it's pointless because it doesn't exist.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know. I was unclear what exactly about this disturbed.
Yeah. Leto. I guess the meaning behind it is kind of confusing or not clear, but at the same time, at least it was an easy epigraph to read because sometimes, you know, they can get a little bit cumbersome. And this was not that. But anyway, I don't think we have much more to say about this.
Yeah. Let's talk about the chapter itself. So we pick up this chapter with Duncan angrily striding down the halls of the Citadel, which actually, now that I'm thinking about it, is the first of two chapters that will begin this way. In this case, Duncan is heading for his rooms, livid after an unpleasant encounter with Mineo in the dining hall. Duncan had been sitting alone going over some documents when Mineo had rolled up and announced that he had a message for Duncan from the God Emperor. Mineo is no good at having a poker face, apparently, and everyone in the room can tell that his tone means business, so the surrounding fish speakers fall silent and listen in. For fuck's sake, Mineo, you didn't think to maybe have this sensitive conversation somewhere private? Some administrator he is.
He doesn't have his own office?
Yeah, I mean, he must somewhere, and also, I just don't understand why he thought it would be best to, like, confront Duncan about this publicly and create gossip among the fish speakers when he could have just, like, had a private chat.
Yeah.
Just seems weird. So, at any rate, Mineo announces, again, with all the fish speakers listening, that Leto considers it bad luck that Duncan has become enamored of Hui Nori, and that this mischance must not continue. Mineo says that for Duncan to continue his foolish crush on Hui is dangerous, as Hui is meant for Leto. Duncan can't stop himself from protesting that Leto can't marry Hui, and demands to know what game Leto is playing. Mineo's like, yo, hold up, I'm just the messenger here. But Duncan insists on knowing whatever Leto has confided in Mineo, and Mineo lies that Leto sympathizes with Duncan, who shouts in anger into the silence of the room. Because, as mentioned, everyone else has stopped talking to listen in on this confrontation. Mineo repeats that Hui is obviously attractive, but she is not meant for Duncan, and Duncan responds with derision before getting up, clearly over the conversation. Mineo wants to know where he is going, and Duncan says he is going to have it out with the God Emperor right then and there, which Mineo tells him is suicide. Duncan notices now that all of this is playing out with the fish speakers in the room listening intently, and he begins to use this against Mineo. Duncan starts to criticize Leto, saying that the old Atreides would have said that whenever you look up to an absolute ruler, you lose your liberties. Mineo freezes in fear, whispering to Duncan not to speak in this way, because it's dangerous heresy.
Blasphemous.
Exactly. Duncan challenges him. Why not? Because the fish speakers will report him to Leto? Mineo notes that Duncan is more reckless than his predecessors and begs him to heed the dangers of speaking like this as a frisson of anxiety sweeps through the guards in the room. Duncan retorts that all Leto can do is kill them, and a furious Mineo hisses back that Duncan is a fool and the worm could come to dominate Leto at the slightest provocation. Duncan repeats his words of the worm in a deliberately loud voice so that all the surrounding women can hear. Mineo tries to do damage control, telling Duncan that he must just trust Leto, and Duncan notes that the women have all heard this statement, at least. Mineo tries to defend Leto to Duncan, but after Duncan implies that Leto does evil things, Mineo runs away in fear, saying that he washes his hands of Duncan. The fish speakers in the room are all staring at Duncan, and he basically shrugs as he says that Mineo doesn't judge, but I do. He is surprised to note that several of the women smile wryly before they all turn back to their meals. I wonder if this is just because eventually many of the Duncans start acting like this, and they're kind of just like, ugh, that Duncan. Or if they're, like, genuinely sympathizing with his position because they're unhappy about the Hui situation. It's a little bit unclear because we don't really get a fish speaker perspective. So, back in the present, with Duncan angrily going back to his rooms, he thinks about the conversation and tries to glean more from Mineo's kind of strange behavior. He feels that Mineo's mentioning of the worm was a slip, and that Mineo's terror seemed much greater than a standard fear of death, but he doesn't know what this means. Duncan is also annoyed at Mineo comparing him to past incarnations of himself, although he wonders whether they had actually been as careful as Mineo wishes him to be. Duncan arrives at his own rooms, and he hesitates before entering, certain that his outburst will have been reported to Leto, and wondering what the God Emperor will do in retaliation. He unseals the palm lock and enters, wondering if the fish speakers will be sent for him. He looks at the entryway to his rooms, which includes a weapon cabinet, bitterly reflecting that it contains nothing that could hurt Leto, not even a laser gun. He comes to believe that this is because Leto knows that Duncan will eventually defy him. Of course, this is probably true. He enters the sitting area, which Mineo has updated to remove the softer furniture it initially contained, according to Duncan's taste, and Duncan is shocked to see Hui herself sitting there waiting for him, wearing a revealing blue gown. She is thankful that he has so far not been hurt. Duncan glances back at the previously palm-locked door in obvious confusion, and Hui smiles as she notes that the locks are of Ixian manufacture, so it was presumably quite easy for her to overcome. Duncan is afraid for her and asks why she's here, and she replies that they must talk about them. She says that she has been told to reject him, and he initially believes that Mineo must have spoken to her, but she instead reveals that two of the fish speakers who had heard the confrontation in the mess hall had fetched her, believing Duncan to be in great danger. So, I'm assuming the fish speakers brought her here in the hopes that she will reject Duncan and be like, this has to end. And that's obviously not how it goes.
No, not quite.
Hui stands, and the grace of the motion reminds him of the effortlessly lissome movements of the long-dead Jessica, and he immediately thinks that Hui must be a Bene Gesserit. She assures him that while they were among her teachers, she is not one of them, but he is still suspicious, feeling out of his depth and understanding the various factions and allegiances of Leto's empire, so different from those of his previous life. He sarcastically says that she must be nothing more than a simple Ixian, and she chides him not to sneer at her. He demands to know what she is, and she tells him that she is the intended bride of the God Emperor, and that she will serve Leto faithfully. In reply, Duncan says that there is nothing more for them to speak about. Hui disagrees, saying that they must speak of this thing between us. Duncan plays dumb, and she clarifies that she means their mutual attraction, and that they both wish to seek love and shelter in each other's arms. Dungan doesn't move, saying that the God Emperor has forbidden this, but Hui is not deterred, stepping closer to him. He tries to stop her and tell her that it is best that she leave, and she says that this would be prudent, but not best. He is afraid of what Leda will do if he finds out that Hui has been here, but Hui says that it is not her way to leave Dungan like this, saying that she was bred and trained for just one purpose, to woo the God Emperor, which Leda knows, and he wouldn't change anything about her. But she says that as such, she was designed to please an Atreides, and that Leto has told her that his Dungan is more an Atreides than many born to the name. While this does seem like kind of silly semantics, because he's not actually an Atreides, it is true that Dungan is probably the last true representative of at least the old Atreides values, as Leto has pursued his golden path, apparently at the expense of those values. However, it's kind of weird that she's like, oh, I was made to please an Atreides. And you're, like, basically an Atreides, so I can't just leave here without pleasing you. It's very odd.
It's that plus the goat hair, right?
Gotta be. She's just using the Atreides thing as a cover.
She's gotta find out if the carpet matches the drapes.
Dungan is taken aback that Hui calls the God Emperor simply Leto. And she expresses surprise that he would think she would call her betrothed anything else. But even as she says this, she leans in closer to Dungan and places her cheek against his chest. Dungan rests his chin against her hair, breathing in her scent. He says this is crazy, and she agrees before they get down to business. So it is interesting that she goes from, I'm the intended bride of the God Emperor, and I will serve him faithfully, and he's my betrothed, to like, let's get it on. She doesn't seem to see any conflict between these two things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it doesn't seem to bother her at all.
Yeah.
The being unfaithful to Leto.
Which, I mean, you think she would at least have that instinct of, I mean, God Emperor's just going to kill me if he finds out, right? Or kill Dungan, or, you know.
I think she'd be more concerned for Dungan than for herself, but I think she says later that, like, oh, killing you would hurt me, and so he won't do that, which I don't know that that's true.
Yeah, she's making a lot of assumptions there.
Yeah, like, I don't think Leto would hurt her, but I don't know that that protection actually extends to Dungan. As we'll see in the next chapter, it does not seem like it does. So I'm not sure. It also just seems strange to me that, again, this is happening all in such exaggerated timescales.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get into this more in a little bit, but it just, I don't know, she couldn't, like, keep it in her pants until she and Leto at least got married and were, like, exclusive for a little bit before she has to start, you know? It just seems weird. Anyway, fortunately, in the description of what goes down, there is nary a mention of a beef swelling, which I was very grateful for. But Dungan does manage to be super awkward and point out mid-coitus that Hui is not a virgin, which is just an odd thing to comment on. Just in general, the first time or ever that you're having sex with someone. Like, maybe it's something you would discuss, like, before or after, but just to be like, wait. You're not a virgin in the middle of your first bang session. It's like, not something I would consider overly romantic.
But wait, I thought you were pure.
Yeah, that's how it comes off, and it's not cute. For her part, Hui points out that he's not either, which, good for her. But she also addresses him as love, which he repeats back to her in, like, obvious ecstasy. However, he doesn't drop the topic of previous sexual relations for inexplicable reasons, and insists on asking her afterwards who her other lovers were, because this is clearly very important information for him to know. This is the man who's supposed to be an epic charmer of women, like, aggressively questioning this woman about, like, who else have you slept with?
It's all the goat hair. The goat hair masks all of that.
He's just so awkward the whole time. I don't get it. Regardless, Hui explains that she basically had pity sex, I think, with a young man who needed her very much, as she describes it, when she was a teenager. It was a little bit unclear what this was supposed to mean, but it sounded like she just had pity sex with the guy. And she had felt ashamed afterwards, I think because she thought she had let the Ixians down by not saving herself for the God Emperor or something, but they were apparently delighted, and she later decided it had been a test of some kind, and we get no further context.
Also, like, saving yourself for the God Emperor, that just doesn't sound like a good idea anyway.
Also, I mean, clearly she's not.
Yeah, yeah.
So I couldn't figure out why else she would have felt, like, guilty and felt like she disappointed the Ixians, unless it was for that reason, but, like, I don't know. Maybe they're also just, like, big prudes. Who the hell knows?
Who knows?
We don't know much about the Ixians. Dungan, who can't help but take everything so damn personally, scowls that she must have just had sex with him because he needed her. But the ever-patient Hui assures him that this had happened from their love for one another. So, I'll be honest, I have had it up to here with this Romeo and Juliet bullshit. Aren't all these people adults? Who are all these people falling in, like, deep, undying love with each other after knowing each other for, like, a month, if that? Like, Hui rolled in at the beginning of the peregrination, and it has been, like, 2 weeks since the peregrination, and, like, both Leto and Duncan have just, like, completely lost themselves over her. I don't understand. Leto is, like, I don't know, 4,500 years old. Duncan is, like, I guess sort of both super old and not. But, like, also, they are at least adults and should have a better control of their emotions, and I just don't understand why, like, everyone in this book is just, like, losing their mind.
I mean, I think it's part of her, like, Ixion design, right? She's supposed to be someone that someone like Leto would be infatuated with, and I guess Duncan has enough of those elements to also be infatuated with her.
But Duncan is not like Leto at all. Like, that's the whole point, is that he thinks Leto is, like, a betrayal of all Atreides' values.
So maybe that's a hint that they're more alike than you'd think they were. At the very least, you don't have Moneo head over heels in love with her, right? So.
But Moneo is an Atreides.
He is an Atreides, but he's also a lot further removed from the classic Atreides that Duncan knew, right?
Yeah, I don't know. It's just, the short timescale just annoys me. I wish that it had been introduced, like, more slowly over time, and that, like, you know, Hui comes to Arrakis, and, like, over the course of a year, like, maybe every couple of months you see, like, an encounter. But it's just this, like, 2 to maybe 4 weeks of everyone losing their minds over Hui just seems, like, oddly unrealistic.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that would probably draw the story out too long if it was going on for that period of time. But at the same time, I'm comfortable with the Ixion hand-waving concept.
I guess. It just seems weird. Anyway, Duncan bitterly repeats the word love back to Hui, and she comments that Malky had told her once that love was a bad bargain because you get no guarantees. Duncan agrees with this statement, but Hui says that Malky was a fool because love needs no guarantees, and Duncan almost smiles. Hui smiles back, saying that they know it must be love because they want to give joy to each other no matter the consequences. Duncan agrees, but says that he fears for her, asking what they will do. She replies that they will cherish this for as long as we live. Duncan notes that this sounds so final, even though they'll see each other pretty often, but she tells him that they will never again be together like this. He throws himself at her in anguish, and she strokes his hair to comfort him. So she is like, okay, we've got this attraction thing, let's get it out of our system, and then that's it. Which is, like, interesting. Like, I don't think that's how it works. Like, I don't think... It's not like you can just, like, get it out of your system. It's not like Duncan is gonna be like, well, we banged one, so sayonara, sweetheart, I'm done. It's kind of weird, but I don't know. I guess she also knows that she can't just keep maintaining it while Leto tolerates it, but I don't know. I'm not sure what she was trying to accomplish here.
Maybe she just wanted some goat hair.
I guess that must be it. Duncan confesses that he's afraid he could have gotten her pregnant, but she's pretty nonchalant about that, saying that if it happens, it happens, whatever. Duncan doesn't understand why she's so chill about this possibility, since it would then be obvious to Leto that they have been together, but Hui says that Leto will find out anyway, not because he's omniscient, but because Hui herself will tell him, and Duncan sits up and looks at her in a mixture of anger and confusion. He obviously thought this was going to be kept on the DL. And she's like, no, I'm going to tell Leto about it. He's just like, what? So she says that she must tell Leto, though Duncan fears that Leto will lash out against her in retaliation, knowing the stories of Leto's anger, obviously referring to the worm. However, Hui is unconcerned, saying that Leto knows that she has her own human needs and that he will not harm either of them. He is incapable of destroying Hui herself, and he will not hurt Duncan because this too would destroy Hui. So Hui is really banking on Leto's generosity here, as we discussed, extending to anyone she considers a friend or whatever. But I think that's risky.
Also making a lot of assumptions here. A lot of very hopeful assumptions.
Yeah, also that Hui will give a fuck what happens to Duncan in like a year. Like, sure, she's all caught up in passion now, but if they, like, stop having a tryst and she eventually is like, whatever, I think the minute she doesn't, like, specify that she wants Duncan alive,
also,
Leto would have him killed. Assuming he doesn't have him killed outright anyway.
Yeah, also, as we know from Mineo's interactions with Leto, you know, if the worm takes over, anything could happen, right?
Duncan, or even Hui would be toast in that case.
Yeah.
So, Duncan doesn't understand how Hui could marry Leto, and she asked whether Duncan can't see that Leto needs her even more than Duncan does. Duncan doesn't get it, because they can't have a physical relationship, and she acknowledges that they both know that she and Leto will not share the same type of pairing that she and Duncan feel, but that instead he has larger plans and larger needs, more than anything Duncan or Hui could ever experience. Duncan asks what these are, and she tells him to ask Leto, although she confirms that she herself already knows. She argues that Leto has goodness and honesty within him, and that whatever the Ixians have made her allow her to read more of Leto than even they expected or wanted her to know. Duncan doesn't understand how Hui can believe anything Leto says, and he tries to pull away from her. She tries to tell him to go see Leto, but Duncan retorts that Leto will never see him again. I think implying that Leto would refuse to see him after this betrayal rather than that he's just gonna, like, disappear.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not 100% clear. But Hui assures him that Leto will see him. Duncan says that he is now a hostage, and that Hui has made him afraid of her and Leto together. She kisses his hand and said, I never thought it would be easy to serve God. I just didn't think it would be this hard. So at this point in the chapter, I was genuinely wondering whether this was all a part of the Ixians' plans. Because it would honestly make a lot more sense if that was the case. I just don't know if it is. That Hui is meant not only to appeal to and distract Leto, but also to do the same to Duncan, specifically to sow discord between them.
That's possible.
Like, as I said, she just seems to be shockingly nonchalant about this whole scenario. Like, she expresses no, like, guilt or, like, indecision or, like, I don't know what we should do. She seems completely, like, unconflicted about what she's doing here with Duncan versus what Leto will think about it.
Yeah, and she's sure it's all going to work out exactly as she expects it to.
And it just seems like, I don't see how this sleeping with Duncan, which she knows is going to make Leto upset, I don't know how that fits in with her alleged, like, deep desire not to hurt Leto. So, I don't know. She seems like she's actively betraying his wishes in this particular way. And she seems sincere, and maybe she is, but I'm having a tough time telling if this is part of the trap for Leto, or simply an unfortunate coincidence with, like, the timing of the new Duncan's arrival.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, they happen to be attracted to each other. Or maybe it was deliberately timed with the new Duncan arriving right when Hui did via collaboration between the Ixians and Salaxu. But then I feel like I'm just like Charlie from Always Sunny with the red string and the
conspiracy theorizing
and the conspiracy board. So
yeah.
But it just, I don't know, Hui's behavior in this chapter just seems so weird to me unless she's deliberately trying to screw things up. But she also seems completely genuine and sincere whenever we, like, see her perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So I just find it really difficult to figure out what's going on here. Maybe, I don't know. Because you have to wonder what would have happened if Hui had arrived when the old Duncan was still around. Because theoretically this wouldn't have been a problem because he had, like, a wife and kids and was theoretically happy with them.
Yeah, but would she have been too overpowering with her, like, attraction to these, like, Atreides-like people?
I don't know. I would hope that Duncan would have more, like, honor than that, right?
Especially if he's, like, a settled Duncan.
Yeah, like, he has, it's not even, like, it's just a girlfriend. Like, he's got a literal wife and children.
Mm-hmm.
So I would think that, given Duncan's frustrations with, like, Atreides' values, like, that the honor of things would at least prevent anything from happening. But I guess we don't know. But, yeah, it's just hard to tell what's going on. I guess we'll find out whether this was deliberate or just, like, some weird coincidence, but both of them are just being real dumb in this chapter. Like, honestly, I don't think Leto would care if Hui slept with almost anyone else. But she has to sleep with the one person that she knows Leto would be really pissed about.
Yeah. Needed that goat hair, like we said. Or you know what? She just hid it and quit it. So maybe the carpet didn't match the drapes. Maybe he's just built like a dolphin.
Right. What does that mean?
just completely hairless. Maybe she likes her men hairier and he did not meet expectations, and that's what this is all about.
She's like, oh yeah, we can't sleep together anymore, this is it. And it's not because of she wants to now be faithful to Leto, it's because she was unimpressed with Duncan's performance. Anyway, definitely a weird chapter, but the key thing is that Duncan and Hui sleep together, and what impact is this going to have going forward?
Mm-hmm. So we're going to have to monitor that.
Mm-hmm. All right, so shall we move on to our next chapter? You want to epigraph us?
Yes. So the next one is also from the Stolen Journals. Memory has a curious meaning to me, a meaning I have hoped others might share. It continually astonished me how people hide from their ancestral memories, shielding themselves behind a thick barrier of mythos. Oh, I do not expect them to seek the terrible immediacy of every living moment which I must experience. I understand that they might not want to be submerged in a mush of petty ancestral details. You have reason to fear that your living moments might be taken over by others. Yet, the meaning is there within those memories. We carry all of our ancestry forward like a living wave, all of the hopes and joys and griefs, the agonies and the exhalations of our past. Nothing within those memories remains completely without meaning or influence, not as long as there is a humankind somewhere. We have that bright infinity all around us, that golden path of forever, to which we can continually pledge our puny but inspired allegiance. So, seems like a lot of mumbo-jumbo, we're all humans, we're all in it together.
Yeah, and he's all like, people hide from their ancestral memories even though they can't access them in the same way I do, and so mm-hmm. I don't know what he was getting at there, other than like just general history, because like people can't experience literal ancestral memory, so the only thing they could have is like oral tradition or history, right?
Yeah, I guess. I sort of just read it as like, you know, humanity is like a ever-moving wave that's constantly changing and shifting, and that, you know, we're all just water droplets in that wave, essentially.
And we should all work together for the benefit of the golden path of infinity or whatever
the hell. The benefit of crashing upon the shore.
Sure, whatever. Do you have anything super insightful or whatever that you want to say about this, or do you just want to dive into the chapter?
That wasn't insightful? That wasn't insightful enough for you? Okay. Yeah, fine. Fine.
I just meant anything else, or are we done with this epigraph?
No. Apparently we're done. We can move on to the chapter now.
All right, so in this chapter, Leto has summoned Maneo to him in the aftermath of the incident with Duncan in the mess hall and what happened afterwards, down to the dark crypt that Leto so loves and Maneo so hates. Maneo has heard the fish speaker's reports himself, and he has been awaiting the summons all day, but he was terrified all the same when they finally came. He asks, cautiously, if Leto wishes to speak about Duncan, and of course this is the case. Leto describes Duncan's behavior as terminal, and demands to know how long until the Stalaxu could make him a new one. Unfortunately for Leto, but probably fortunately for Duncan, it seems there have been some problems with the Stalaxu's process, and it will take up to 2 years.
Mm.
So even longer than Maneo had suspected previously. Leto asks whether Maneo knows what the fishbeakers have told him, and Maneo fears what exactly Leto has been told. He seems to think that the fishbeakers may have been so terrified by what Duncan had done that they might not have told Leto, and that if the perpetrator had been anyone but a Duncan Idaho, the fishbeakers would have killed him themselves. I am assuming that he means that the fishbeakers didn't tell Leto about Duncan and Hui getting physical, but I suppose he might not know about that, and he might just mean Duncan's blasphemous words when Maneo had left. It's unclear what exactly Maneo knows happened.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, it's not like anyone else was in the room, but you could probably make inferences from Duncan and Hui being, like, alone in his rooms for a while. So I'm just, like, not entirely clear who knows what at this point.
I would assume that he knows less rather than more, and he probably doesn't know about that piece, because I would assume he would have had a much more visceral reaction to that type of a...
Yeah, thing. That was my impression, too, and yeah. That Maneo might not even know, but it's not clear that he knows either.
I would think he would tell Leto if he knew.
I would think so, except that he's so afraid of triggering the worm that maybe he wouldn't. I would let someone else be the bearer of bad news there.
Potentially.
But I think Leto maybe won't find out unless and until Hui tells him herself. I wonder if we'll see that interaction. Anyway, Maneo evades speaking about either of those things, whether it's about Duncan and Hui or just Duncan's outburst. But he instead describes how Duncan has apparently been harassing the fish speakers about their parentage and planets of origin and their childhoods, although for what reason I'm not entirely clear. Unless he's just trying to, like, figure out more about the breeding scheme or whatever, but I don't know how many of the fish speakers are deliberately part of that.
Yeah, well, he's voiced his displeasure with how the Empire is set up with, like, nobody going anywhere and everything being as stagnant as it is, so maybe he's just trying to learn more about the people and how they feel about their surroundings. And I know they're gonna be fanatics because they're fish speakers, but at least kind of understand how that half of society lives compared to those who are just, like, you know, the regular peasants, I guess.
Stuck on their own planets.
Yep.
Yeah, because the fish speakers are definitely the most mobile faction of the Empire, you'd think, right? Mm-hmm. They're the only ones who really get to go from planet to planet.
Yeah.
So, apparently this erratic behavior and the harshness with which Duncan had interrogated the fish speakers had frightened the guardswomen. He apparently had not liked their answers. Mineo hopes that this is all that Leto is concerned about, and he asks why the Duncans always do this. So, apparently this particular behavior is part of the standard Sin Syndrome. Leto explains that it is due to the Atreides' training of the original Duncan. The Atreides sought to live in service of those that they governed, and so the Duncans always want to know about the lives of the people under Leto's rule. Mineo points out that Duncan has traveled and spent time in the villages and towns, so he should know what things are like, but Leto bitterly says that evidence means nothing without the judgments of those viewing the evidence. Also, Duncan has visited a couple of places on one planet. It's not like he's gotten a grand tour of the galaxy.
Well, maybe in his previous youth, right? With his previous life.
Yeah, but I mean, like, he hasn't seen the Empire now, and that seems to be what he's concerned about. Like, the lives of people now.
I guess so.
Leto observed that the Duncans always come to believe that the whole universe is a hostage to Leto's will, and that you can't do evil in the name of doing good. Leto clarifies that this isn't just Duncan's viewpoint, but that of all the Atreides within himself. And that the universe won't permit such behavior, and if you try, the things you wrought will crumble. Mineo tries to argue that Leto, being God, can do no wrong, and Leto replies with pity and or condescension at Mineo's lack of comprehension. Mineo gets quite nervous, recognizing that Leto is in a dangerous mood, and that he had been falsely placated by the fact that Leto had seemed relatively chill at the beginning of the conversation. Mineo notes that he is in great danger here in the crypt, even more than in the rooms far above where he had come so close to facing the worm, and he wonders if his time to die has come. Leto continues musing, saying that hostage-taking is a type of enslavement, and the universe will not permit this either. I think human history would have something to say about this point. Mineo really tries to give good answers to the barrage of questions Leto is throwing his way, but eventually he hits a wall when Leto asks him what religious institutions perpetuate. Mineo tries to back away, coming up with no answer, and believing that Leto will kill him in retaliation as the God Emperor orders him to stand where he is. However, Leto does not in fact kill Mineo, and instead seems to take pity on him, saying that, "Then I will tell you, poor servant." Mineo cautiously notes that the God Emperor's hands are not trembling and his eyes are not glazed over, and hopes that he will make it through this alive after all. Leto explains that religious institutions create a mortal master-servant relationship, which attracts people full of pride who hunger for power. Mineo is just, like, nodding, like, "Sure, whatever you say, boss," while watching for signs of the worm. Leto exposits that the Duncans are both too compassionate to those that they deem their peers, but they do not extend this compassion far enough, somehow, and they know that Leto has ignored the admonition of Muhammad and Moses, but he does not explain this illusion, and I assume it is lost on Mineo. He says that Mineo knows this too, but Mineo does not understand and is kind of too busy panicking about the worm and the threat to his safety, so he starts to nod before switching to shaking his head, because he is just, like, completely overwhelmed, and he starts to be like, "Yes," and then he's like, "Wait, no, I actually don't know what you're talking about." And I'm just imagining this poor man just, like, in full panic mode. Mineo wonders if he can start trying to back away again, knowing that this sort of lecture is typically shortly followed by the appearance of the worm. Leto asks Mineo to explain this admonition to him, and poor Mineo simply shrugs, at which Leto takes on a sonorous voice and shouts into the void of the chamber that Mineo and his brethren are servants of God, not servants of servants. And Mineo protests that he serves Leto himself, so he is serving God. Leto's voice returns to normal as he says that a million wrongs cannot make a right, and that what is right is known because it lasts. Leto then also reveals that he had apparently intended for Hui to have children with Mineo, but now it's too late. I'm not sure why. Because she's into Duncan, or because he does know that Duncan and Hui had sex, or... I'm not sure. I don't know why it's too late. Maybe Duncan did manage to knock Hui up, but again, I don't think Leto knows about this. But also, it's, like, super not cool to expect your bride to have to bang your super old servant if she wanted to have children. Because his whole thing was like, let me pick the father of your children if you want them. And he apparently was going to make her bang Mineo. Because Mineo is, like, over 100, right? And not taking spice. So I can't imagine he's exactly in the prime of his life.
No, I mean, any children would be taken care of, right? So that's not, like, really as much of a concern, but I don't know.
I just mean you have to bang this super old man if you want to have babies. Doesn't seem cool.
Leto's world is weird.
Yeah.
He's created an odd empire.
Uh-huh. Anyway, Mineo is still so panicked and afraid that he's going to die imminently that it takes him a moment to understand what Leto has said. And he has to remind himself who Hui even is for a minute. He's like, ah, yes, the Ixid ambassador. Before the, like, realization of what Leto is actually said sets in.
Didn't realize Hui was such a common name.
Right? And Mineo shakes his head in confusion or disbelief or something, because he clearly is just, like, not processing. Leto switches to a deeply sad voice as he says, you too shall pass away. Will all your works as dust be forgotten? Which is just, like, unnecessarily ponderous. And then even as he speaks, with no warning, the worm seems to come over Leto, and he begins to convulse, and he thrashes himself off his cart, coming mere centimeters from squishing poor faithful Mineo, who, straight out, shrieks and sprints away across the crypt. Leto calls after him, and he stops at the edge of the lift out of this accursed place, as the God Emperor shouts that he will test Siona the next day. So, poor Mineo has been almost smushed, like, twice in a span of a couple days.
Yeah.
I really feel like rough. He needs to institute a policy of he will only talk to Leto through, like, a glass wall. I'm just like, you know what, man? Over Zoom. He needs to have Zoom meetings with Leto. So that if Leto freaks out, he just, like, smashes the computer screen.
I don't know. Even Mineo and how loyal he is and how valuable he is to Leto, I don't know if he even has the clout to make that kind of a demand. But
I don't think he does, but yeah, I'm just saying it's getting spicy for Mineo. This situation is not good for Mineo's health.
Yeah, no, it's bad. Bad, like, for mental health, bad for physical health, especially if you're squished.
Like, exactly. Because, like, good. Yeah, even if you evade being squished, which he almost has been, like, this time even worse than last time, but last time he only got out of the room just in time. But even if you do avoid being squished, just, like, poor Mineo's, like, heart rate and stress and blood pressure and all of these things, like, it can't be good for the man.
Right.
But fortunately, he makes it out to live another day. And later provides us quite a good transition, because our next chapter will, in fact, be about Siona's testing, theoretically beginning the next day. So this also sucks for Mineo, because he goes from, oh my god, I almost died, oh my god, I almost died, oh my god, I almost died, to, oh cool, now my daughter might die. Not great. No. Not a great couple of days for Mineo.
Certainly not. Alright, so shall we move on to our next chapter?
Yeah.
Okay, so the next one begins again with an epigraph from the Stolen Journals. The realization of what I am occurs in the timeless awareness which does not stimulate nor delude. I create a field without self or center, a field where even death becomes only analogy. I desire no results. I merely permit this field which has no goals nor desires, no perfections, nor even visions of achievements. In that field, omnipresent primal awareness is all. It is the light which pours through the windows of my universe.
So, I don't quite understand what he's getting at here, because he definitely has goals and outcomes that he's working towards. Right?
So, the golden path ultimately is engineered to accomplish something. But I think what Leto's point is that his part in it is just creating this setting for humanity that he's established. And that he's not trying to drive a certain result necessarily, but he is trying to, we've talked previously about, like, the stream with the bubbles, right? He's basically trying to own his bubble, and his bubble is basically defining the setting that he has created with his empire for humanity.
Yes, but that requires a lot of specific goals and machinations and everything, so I just think the characterization of, like, I'm not making anything specific happen, and I'm just, like, letting events unfold as they will, is not an accurate characterization.
Yeah, but I think ultimately, yes, there's going to be, like, certain tasks he needs to accomplish along the way, but at the very end...
I mean, he's micromanaging a whole empire for, like, millennia.
He is, but I think what this means is essentially that, like, the goal isn't a specific result. The goal is the setting he's created and this world that he has fostered for humanity.
Okay.
That's my interpretation of it.
Whatever. I mean... Maybe, with the context of what is the golden path, this might make more sense, but oh wait, we still don't know. If we get to the end of this book and it is not made clear what the golden path is, I will be so mad. If I have to wait until the next book, I'm not going to be happy about it.
What if it isn't revealed in the next book and you have to wait for the book after that?
Okay, that will be absolute bullshit. If like, well after Leto's death, we still don't know what the golden path is, I'm going to be mad.
Anyway, shall we dive into the chapter?
Yes, let's. So, we begin the chapter in the midst of Siona's test, as she follows Leto out into the dunes of the Serere. He muses that the older he gets, the more vulnerable he becomes, and he thinks about the Ixion satellites which control clear blue skies of his little patch of desert. Well, I don't think it's actually that little, but relative to the planet as a whole, I suppose. He is amused by the apparent misinterpretation of the Ixions that he had initially wished for the weather satellites to practice hydraulic despotism, and use the weather to punish his enemies, clearly thinking that such crude methods of brutality are beneath him. Siona stops to admire the view at the top of their current dune. Leto takes off, slithering across the sand, and Siona follows in unusual humility. Leto notes this approvingly, reflecting that the doubt sown by his own words, the stolen journals, and Maneo's warnings have done their work on her. Leto had listened in while Maneo had fitted Siona into the genuine Fremen stillsuit that she now wears, and shown her how to use the suit's various tubes. Siona had asked her father what to expect, but he had been able to tell her very little, only that it is different for each person. He had only been able to tell her that the worm will come, and she must find a way to live through this experience. Out on the desert, Shai Hulud is never far away. Siona asks about just not going, but it doesn't sound like she has a choice, though Maneo says that she might never return from this little adventure. After she was suited up, Leto had come down from his aerie at the little citadel, and they had all emerged into the desert, Maneo leaving on his thopter, with the entrance to the little citadel firmly sealed behind them in case Siona tried to make a run for it. The only way out for Siona is to cross the desert with Leto. He had set off and hadn't even had to command her to follow, because it's not like she has another option. He moves ahead of her, compacting the sand such that it is easier for her to walk on, moving slowly and emphasizing that he has command of this terrain. On top of another tall dune, Siona turns and gasps as she sees that the huge tower of the little citadel is barely a blip on the horizon behind them. And Leto tells her that this is what the desert used to be like. Siona is experiencing the true desert, the ocean without water, for the first time. No landmarks, no references, just endless expanses of sand. However, we learn from Leto's thoughts that even these dunes are slowly deteriorating without the harsh desert storms to whip up the sands. Siona asks whether Leto has a personal religion, and he questions that she would dare to ask him such a thing. She feels fear, but she hides it, turning to face him directly, and Leto notes aloud the trademark audacity of her bloodline. Eventually he answers, essentially confessing to a form of deism, I think, that something cannot emerge from nothing without some kind of divine intervention. He uses a Latin expression in his explanation, which confuses Siona, as neither she nor anyone else in this time speaks such a language. He says that this is to prod your ancient memories, but she retorts that she has none. She just wants to know why he has brought her here, and he says that it is to give her a taste of her past. Leto bids her to climb on top of his back, and, again, not really having another option, she does so, although she feels kind of silly kneeling on top of his back, since she obviously doesn't have and can't use maker hooks to stand like a Fremen would. Leto says that he wants her to experience what it was like for the ancient Fremen, her ancestors back through Chaney, to have ridden a sandworm in the old deserts of Dune. He muses that she has no idea what this test is going to entail, and he forces himself to guard his feelings, admonishing himself that he must allow her to die if it comes to that, and that this even applies to his dear Hui, as any one of their deaths might be required for the Golden Path. We get an interesting tidbit here. It was just that all of them could not die. So, if all of Leto's friends die, it's a problem, but if only some of them die, apparently, the Golden Path might still persist. It is interesting that here he is considering that Hui might have to die, and I wonder how that bodes for her and or Duncan. It doesn't sound like he has any antipathy towards her. He's not like, I'm going to kill that bitch. But it's just the acknowledgement that something might happen to Hui. And that it would be bad, but okay. If it promoted the golden path.
Acceptable losses.
Yeah. Anyway, Leto swims out across the desert with Siona balanced on his back. Both of them enjoying the experience. Leto caught up in the illusion he has created of the distant past, although he knows it can never be anything more than a fantasy, as long as his enforced tranquility reigns. He is abruptly struck by the thought that this maintained desert is ridiculous, and he thinks about everything that goes into maintaining the illusion, before eventually just losing himself in the enjoyment of the desert. He knows that most people don't understand his obsession with it, and in fact actively dislike the desert, but he can tell that Siona is captivated by it, and he thinks that her ancient memories must be beginning to be stirred up. He brings them up to a high erg, and they can both feel the electric charge in the air, and they both find it invigorating. As they proceed, Leto begins to tell Siona about the Fremen and their shared ancestry. She is interested and engaged in the conversation, but he can also tell that she is becoming increasingly fearful, as she is carried farther and farther from where they began, and she can recognize nothing. She's afraid that Leto is just engaging in small talk ahead of whatever important event he is leading her towards. We do get an interesting detail here where Leto describes the ancient Fremen as having equality between men and women, which I would disagree with, allegedly because of the need for survival, which was paramount overall. While Siona states that the modern fish speakers say that men and women are not equal, and I would assume that they say that women are superior, which I think we had wondered about previously what gender equity was like in this century. So we don't get any real specifics here, but it sounds like the implication is that at least among the fish speakers, they consider women to be the superior gender.
Well, it seems like they have a very strict caste system of the fish speakers and then everyone else.
I'm just going to say, is it really a caste system? They're just two groups. And the one group is the military.
Yeah, which also...
I think that's just a police state.
Yeah, which also isn't just the fish speakers. It's also any administrators that Leto has decided to promote. Right, like mm-hmm. Maneo and anybody else, the other Maneos of the universe.
I don't know if anyone else is quite a Maneo, but yeah. They come to a stop between some dunes, and Siona demands to know why she had been brought out here. And Leto bids her to look behind them, pointing out that the wind has covered whatever tracks they have left. Growing more fearful, she again demands to know why she is here. Leto, as usual, is a mysterious asshole, saying things like, "But I have told you," and she's like, "No, you have not." He then asks how far she thinks they have come, and reveals that it is a greater distance than she thinks. Didn't she feel the wind on her face? Because, again, I can't emphasize this enough, he's just a dick. He then bids her to get down off his back, and she is suspicious that he will abandon her here, alone in the desert with no way out. But for now, he does not, instead telling her that they have been out in the desert for 4 hours and traveled nearly 60 kilometers. She asks why this information is particularly important, and he bids her to eat some of the dried food that Maneo has put in her robe while he tells her. It is apparently authentic old Fremen food and even has a little spice in it. Leto says that she had felt her past, and that she now must feel her future, the Golden Path. She dismissively says that she doesn't believe in it. Leto warns her that if she is going to live, she will believe it. Annoyed and still defiant, she mocks, asking if that is really his vaunted test. Believe in him or die? Leto replies that she need not have faith in him, but only in herself. So, cryptic as always. She asks again why is it important how far they have traveled, and he says it is so she understands how far there still is to go. He bids her to look around and see herself surrounded by the infinity of the desert, and tells her that the two of them are going to walk out of the desert together. She points out, sneeringly, that he doesn't walk. And he basically shrugs and says, sure, but she'll certainly walk. So no more rides for her, I guess. He warns her that even if she could find her way back to the little citadel, there's nothing there that she could use for survival, not even water. She carefully takes a drink from her still suit, but Leto notes that she doesn't cover her mouth with the suit, as she wants it free for talking. Which maybe seems short-sighted, if you want to conserve water for a trip of unknown length in the desert.
Yeah.
They discuss her options and that she is technically free to go if she so chose, but where could she go? Even if she hypothetically picks a direction in which she could strike out on her own, Leto warns her that to go that way would bury her beneath a sandslide. She asks if they hadn't better get moving, and he's like, there's no rush. Clearly somewhat nervous, she points out that, well, they don't have water out here, but he says that her stillsuit can keep her alive if she uses it right. When she tries to ask for how long, he gets annoyed with her impatience. Trying another tack, she points out that they don't have much food to eat. And he notes that she keeps saying we, but none of these things impact him. He doesn't need food or water out here. He points out that she depends on him, and she admits that she doesn't know how to survive out in the desert, and that Leto does. He says that he will share his precious knowledge of this with her, but she must find something valuable to share with him in turn. She points out that he is only obtaining her acquiescence through threats, and this is no true agreement. He retorts that he has used no violence against her, and she wisely points out that violence can take many forms. He acknowledges this, that he has brought her out to this place that could kill her, and she points out that she didn't exactly have a choice about participating in this ritual at all. He appears to sympathize, telling her that it is difficult to be born an Atreides, and she argues that he doesn't have to do things like this, but he tells her she is wrong before turning away and heading down the face of the dune. She follows wordlessly. Leto stops in the shadow of a dune and says they will wait here for the rest of the day, and she will use less water moving by night. So, that's all we see of her test for now.
I gotta say, I agree with her. His, you know, I'm not being violent towards you, but, like, leaving someone in the desert to die is, like...
Yeah, it's not like...
That's a logical fallacy on his part,
yeah, for sure. It's not like he went up to her and was like, hey, we're gonna do this test that involves me bringing you out into the desert and you having to, like, do what I say or die out there. Do you want to come along? She was forced into doing this, and then her options are, like, do what he wants or die in the desert. So, like, I would definitely agree that that's a type of violence.
Yeah.
Just because he's not slapping her backhanded across the face does not mean that it is not violent. Coercion is a form of violence. And he's just like, sucks to be an Atreides, bitch. I have to do this. You just don't understand. Makes you wonder if he did, like, the exact same thing to Mineo, or if it's, like, always a little bit different. Maybe Mineo had to, like, I don't know, run a fucking obstacle course. All right. Anything else to say about this chapter? I mean, right now, we don't get much about what the test actually entails. Like, I assume there's more to it than just, like, follow Leto out of the desert.
Yeah, this is just a little bit more set up.
Yeah. I assume there's going to be something in which the golden path is revealed to her, and she has to, you know, the way it seems like Mineo had his eyes open to it and was like, I'm on Team Leto now.
Yeah, so the Siona testing piece is sort of reminiscent, for me at least, to the Leto in the desert at Jakarutu slog from the last book that we read.
Oh, that's not encouraging.
So, well, it's not as long, but it's sort of similar.
It's where, like, broken up into bits, so we, like, yeah, see a little bit and then a little bit and then a little bit.
You get little trickles of information like this. So actually, this is part of why I wanted to do four chapters this time.
Just, like, start getting through more of it.
Yeah, try to chunk through it and line up some of the chapters so we'll be able to, you know, get through more of that faster.
Okay.
Just to line things up a little bit better.
Okay.
Because it does tend to drag if you're going one at a time with them.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think this is kind of more set up for the remaining test and what we'll see in those other chapters related to the test.
Okay, cool. Looking forward to see what that actually ends up being.
Mm-hmm. Alright, so moving on.
Now for something completely different.
Our final epigraph today is again from the Stolen Journal, so we're 4 for 4 today. One of the most terrible words in any language is soldier. The synonymous parade through our history, Yogani, trooper, hussar, Karibo, Cossack, Daranzif, Legionary, Sardaukar, Fish Speaker, I know them all. They stand there in the ranks of my memory to remind me. Always make sure you have the army with you.
Yeah, so I mean, Leto seems to be, like, frustrated with the idea that you need armies, but also, like, well, you need armies, or you need soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what really position he's taking there, because he's like, there's not a worst word in the language, but you need them at your back.
Yeah.
Anything else to add?
Not really. I mean, this doesn't really seem like that deep of an epigraph, right? Okay. It's just sort of, the role of the soldier has always been present in history, and at this point in time, he has the army with him, which is important because you want to have the, you know, stronger military force with you, mm-hmm. so you can prevent yourself from getting overthrown. That's what I read into it. I don't know if there's much more there.
Yeah, I think it'd be pretty tough for Leto to maintain control if he did not have control of the military.
Right. I don't think many people would be like, all right, let's follow the worm guy and
just roll with it. You need your army of fanatics.
I mean, yeah, having the context of, you know, the Muad'Dib prophecy and everything that sort of followed that is important as well, but helps to have the big guns, too.
All right. Shall we dive into the chapter?
Let's do it.
All right. So we go from the Sabir back to the Citadel, where, for the second time in four chapters, an incensed Duncan is storming through the Citadel, in this case hunting for Mineo, finally finding him in an underground passage speaking with a Fishbeaker guard captain. Duncan is annoyed by how he can tell the corridor is meant to look like an old Fremen siege, but the glow strips lighting the way would never have been in a siege in the old days. They were an impractical use of energy compared with glow globes, but Leto doesn't let a small thing such as practicality stand in the way of what he wants. Duncan angrily stalks down the corridor towards Mineo, passing a number of small rooms blocked only by curtains in the entrances. The area provides housing for many of the young Fishbeaker cohorts, and there are kitchens, armories, dining halls, and so on. Unfortunately for Duncan, there are also a number of Fishbeakers hooking up behind the flimsy curtains, and the mere existence of homosexuality in his general vicinity makes Duncan even more angry, because as righteous as he feels about all the things Leto has done, he's also a raging homophobe. Mineo turns as he hears Duncan approach, because I'm pretty sure Duncan is loudly storming down the hall. And the Fishbeaker commander he had been speaking with retreats back into her room. Or the room. Duncan is in no mood for introductory pleasantries, and he immediately demands to know where Leto is. Although Mineo is in no mood to be helpful to Duncan, and pretends not to know what he means at first. Mineo notes a sheathed knife with a jeweled handle at Duncan's belt, and he's uneasy as he wonders where it came from. So in this exchange, Mineo is not forthcoming about anything he knows, Duncan threatens him, and Mineo warns him to cut the shit, but he does reveal that Leto is out in the desert with Siona. There's a wonderful exchange where Duncan says, with your daughter, and Mineo just deadpans, is there another Siona? Mineo is low-key savage in this whole chapter, and I kind of love it. Duncan demands to know what they're doing out there and when they'll return, and Mineo says Siona is being tested, but he doesn't know when they'll be back. He asks why Duncan is being so unreasonably angry. Duncan tries to ask more about the test, but Mineo just redirects him back to the question of why he's so mad. Duncan says that he hates this place and the Fishbeakers, and he spits to punctuate his statement. Mineo looks back down the corridor Duncan had just walked down, thinks about what he knows about the Duncans, and pieces together that Duncan is dealing poorly with having to face the existence of homosexuals, because I can't emphasize this enough. Duncan is an immature man-child who can't comprehend that not everyone has the same sexuality that he does, and reacts with rage instead of questioning himself when confronted with this fact. Mineo seems to share this general opinion, wondering why he bothers putting up with this foolish, dangerous, antique human. As I said, Mineo, in his thoughts and his words, is just savage in this chapter. He is, like, so done with Duncan being an asshole. And just, like, interfering with his plans. He tries to explain to Duncan that in their society, it's perfectly normal and natural for adolescents of either gender to have homosexual attractions in their youth, and that most will grow out of it. Of course, this is also a simplistic and inaccurate take compared with reality, but it certainly reveals far more tolerance and acceptance than Duncan's response of, it should be stamped out! Mineo tries to protest that it is a part of their heritage. Duncan is not having it, and Mineo basically rolls his eyes and tells Duncan that trying to suppress something would only make it stronger anyway. So, I mean, like, cracking down on it would not suddenly make people not gay.
Yeah, it's not how it works.
Duncan glares at Mineo and pivots to the topic of Siona's testing, demanding to know what this is all about. Exasperated, Mineo tells him that it means that Siona might die out in the desert with Leto, which does manage to bring Duncan up short for a moment as he tries to understand why Mineo would allow such a thing. Mineo points out that his permission wasn't exactly required for this activity, but ever-righteous Duncan says that everyone has a choice in matters. Mineo flat-out asks him why he is so much dumber than the previous Duncans. This topic sets Duncan off all over again because he does not like being reminded of his predecessors, and he demands to know how those men had died. Mineo gives a vague answer. They died the way anyone does, by running out of time. Duncan accuses him of lying, hand on his knife. Mineo, smiling pleasantly all the while, warns Duncan to cool it, because even he has a limit to what he will tolerate. Duncan goes back to the topic of lesbians, gesturing back at the corridor, and exclaiming that the whole place is rotten, and there are some things he will never come to accept. Mineo, frustrated, tells Duncan that he needs to grow up. Things with Leto are strange and sensitive, and Maneo really does not need Duncan upsetting or unsettling Leto in any way. Duncan clearly wants to fight more, but he's held back for the moment by something in Maneo's voice. From our vantage point as the readers, it's presumably Maneo's deep fear of triggering the worm. Especially given his two near-death experiences of the past few days. Duncan tries to protest that he's not some child that Maneo can order around, but Maneo responds with an angry outburst, accusing Duncan of being caught between his body demanding maturity and his mind being trapped in adolescence, which leads to nasty behavior or something. Duncan seems to believe that Maneo is accusing him of being a homosexual himself with this statement, but Maneo says that he's not, regardless of what Duncan saw in the corridor, which is not important anyway and is just youth exploring itself. Duncan is not at all pacified, saying that he is glad to learn about Maneo, clearly meaning this in an unflattering manner, while Maneo twists in a knife of his own. Yes, well, I've learned about you several times, which makes Duncan uncomfortable because, again, he doesn't like being reminded of this. He demands to know what exactly Maneo has learned from his predecessors. Maneo says that previous Duncans have taught him valuable things. Specifically, people try to evolve, but if they are blocked from doing so, they express this lost potential either by seeking out or visiting pain upon others. This is apparently something that adolescents are particularly vulnerable to. Again, Duncan interprets this as an implication that he has so-called adolescent homosexual inclinations and threatens Maneo, who finally tells him to shut up, and Duncan can't help but obey the command in Maneo's voice. Maneo apologizes for the outburst and says that his concern for Siona has distracted him. Duncan says that Maneo is crazy, as he acknowledges that Siona might be dying as they speak, and yet he still serves the God Emperor. Maneo, who is completely over Duncan's nonsense right now, tells Duncan that his concerns are petty and selfish and that his questions are stupid. Duncan says he's making allowances for Maneo's rudeness because of the situation with Siona, and Maneo is livid at the idea that Duncan is the one making allowances for him and not the other way around. Duncan is like, I am generously allowing you to be mean to me. And Maneo is like, I'm sorry, what? You're allowing me? Duncan says that he can forgive Maneo, but Maneo interrupts him to rage about his hookup with Hui. Or if he doesn't know about the hookup. Unclear at this point whether he knows about it, but he certainly knows that they've been, like, seeing each other when they're supposed to. Mm-hmm. Duncan wants to leave Hui out of it, but Maneo isn't having this, and he asks Duncan whether he ever thought of how things would end with her, and whether he ever considered the pain of their parting in his decision to court her, basically. Duncan is somewhat impressed despite himself at the passion of Maneo's outburst, which does, in fact, manage to ignite some shame in him, because obviously he hadn't really thought of it from this angle. Maneo continues, saying that his cruelty is limited to making Duncan think about the things he would rather ignore, but that far worse has been done to Leto for no reason other than cruelty itself. Duncan demands to know why Maneo is defending Leto. Maneo says that he knows him best, while Duncan accuses Leto of using Maneo. Maneo tries to explain that Leto is the best hope for the perpetuation of humanity, but Duncan gets hung up on the perversion in the Empire preventing the perpetuation of humanity. Apparently of the belief that homosexuality is contagious and soon nobody will be making babies or something. I'm not entirely sure how a couple of fish beakers hooking up prevents the perpetuation of humanity, but Duncan seems very convinced that
See, that's the truth behind the Golden Path. Leto is trying to unleash the big gay on everyone in the Empire.
He's making the frogs gay. Making everybody gay.
He's making the frogs gay. He's making the fish speakers gay. Everybody gonna be gay in Leto's Empire.
It certainly seems like the fish speakers have no problem hooking up with men given their obsession with having Duncan babies. So
yeah.
I don't think this is as widespread of a problem that Duncan seems to think it is.
You thought coronavirus is bad? Wait until you get a hold of the gay plague. It's coming for you.
So from here, we get one of several interesting takes on homosexuality in this book. And Maneo gives a definitely super inaccurate explanation of homosexuality throughout history, claiming that homosexuals have historically been important warriors and berserkers and religious figures, and that it is no accident that celibacy is part of many religions, and that adolescents make the best soldiers. Certainly, adolescents being soldiers could have nothing to do with being in the prime of youth physically, and also more easy to beat or break or brainwash or whatever into a unified fighting force. No, it's definitely because of that weird adolescent homosexuality connection that I still don't quite understand. Also, what is this, like, gay berserker thing? Like, I've never once heard of, like, a society in which, like, specifically all the berserkers were, the famous berserkers were gay. Unless I've just missed that in, like, myths, but...
You see, that's, like, every Special Forces team is just a band of homosexuals, right? Is that what happens?
I don't know. I'm so confused by every reference to homosexuality in these books. I never know what the point is supposed to be.
Yeah.
Anyway, Duncan exclaims that this is perversion, and Mineo agrees, I think, but then says that commanders have taken advantage of sexual desires being sublimated into a desire to inflict pain for all of history. And he points out that a fighting force is easier to manage when their violence is motivated by deep-seated desires. Again, I just don't even want to address this. It makes no sense, and it's dumb. Like, again, this whole, like, fighting forces are secretly gay or, like, trying to fight against being gay or, like, whatever point they're making, just, I think soldiers are just soldiers and some of them are straight and some of them are gay and it has nothing to do with how they fight.
Yeah, I mean, in some of this stuff, like, take out the homosexuality bits and, like, him trying to make the point that, like, you know, the desire piece is a really strong connection. Like, if you're trying to connect that to, like, if you're fighting for something you're really passionate about and it's really deeply rooted in you, and, you know, if that's the case, you're going to be a better soldier because you're going to really care about what you're fighting for, and you're not just some mercenary who's just doing it for, like, payday or, you know, some other reason. Sure. But the fact that they're, like, connecting it to this thing that it's not connected to, it just makes it miss the mark, I think.
Yeah, and there's, like, all these implications of, like, oh, well, like, they would rather be out banging people, but they can't because they're in an all-male army, so they get these homosexual urges, but that makes them mad, and that makes them stronger fighters because they're, like, expressing their suppressed desires through fighting. It's just, like, so convoluted and confusing, and I'm not even sure that's what they're trying to say, but that's, like, the best thing that I can piece together from this, and, like, let's just accept that it's bullshit and move on.
Yeah, it's so weird. Like, are they just gonna, like, hook them all up in chastity belts and make them go Hulk mode or something? Because the desire just drives them nuts.
I don't get it. And then women are somehow immune to this because babies or something.
Yeah. I guess the secret truth is that all the greatest berserkers of our time wore chastity belts. That must be what happened.
Must be it. Anyway, a disgusted Duncan accuses Leto of having made Mineo into a monster just like him. Minus the sandworm, I guess. Mineo tells Duncan that if Leto uses him, it is with Mineo's permission, as he believes that the price Leto pays is far greater than anything he has ever asked of Mineo himself. Duncan challenges him, asking if this is true even if the price is his daughter. Mineo says that if Leto will sacrifice everything, why not him as well? He says that Duncan should understand this trait of the Atreides, as the other Duncans have always been good at this. Duncan gets angrier again at the mention of his predecessors. Mineo twists the knife one more time, telling Duncan that he simply doesn't have the guts to pay the price that Leto demands. At this, Duncan totally loses his cool and tries to straight up murder Mineo, whipping his knife out and trying to stab him, moving at blinding speed. But despite his advanced age, Mineo is even faster, quickly sidestepping the attack, tripping Duncan, and pushing him face first into the floor. So not only does he, like, dodge out of the way, he, like, throws Duncan to the floor.
Mm-hmm.
Like, with minimal effort. Duncan starts to leap to his feet, but then stays on the ground as the fact that he has just tried to kill an Atreides sets in. Mineo looks down at him with some degree of sadness on his face and says that if he wants to kill him, he'll need to do it by stealth and stab him in the back. Duncan might have a chance at success that way. Duncan can hardly comprehend what has just happened, unable to figure out how Mineo had moved so quickly and effortlessly and gracefully. He starts to ask, but Mineo speaks over him, one last gut punch to the Gola to close out the encounter. He's been breeding us for a long time, Duncan, strengthening many things in us. He has bred us for speed, for intelligence, for self-restraint, for sensitivity. You're just an older model. And that's the end of the chapter.
Bitch got owned!
He did. And you know what? Bitch he got deserved owned. It.
Yep.
I think Mineo had some weird ideas about homosexuality, but I think Duncan deserved to get, like, punched out in this chapter. for just being a dick.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can come yelling at Mineo about whatever shit you think Leto's doing, but to just be like, those damn lesbians got me so mad. It's just so stupid. Of all the things to get worked up about of what Leto's doing in the Empire, allowing the fish speakers to hook up is, like, bottom of the list.
Yeah, honestly, this whole fucking chapter is weird. Like,
it is.
I think, like, the core aspects, not of the conversation itself, but just of the interaction, just the fact that you have Duncan getting worked up about something that's a certain way in Leto's Empire, and Mineo calmly explaining to him why it is the way it is, and then, you know, the piece about Siona getting thrown in there. Like, all of that is legitimate. And then the thing at the end, too, like, that's legitimate, too,
well,
right?
And, like,
it's been thousands
the chapter,
of years.
Like, Mineo is just clearly, like, so annoyed with this Duncan's, like, retrograde opinions and the fact that he's just being an asshole all the time. And he is, like, the clearly building, like, oh, my God, I can't believe I have to deal with this guy. And Duncan, who views Mineo as, like, this slimy coward who won't stand up to Leto even as he's, like, potentially murdering his daughter. And, like, all that interaction is interesting and cool. And I love the bit at the end. Well, I just love Mineo's, like, shit throughout the whole chapter where he's just, like, throwing knives at Duncan the whole time. And at the end, like, literally just takes him out. But, yeah, just the actual topic of much of the conversation in the chapter is dumb.
Yeah, it's just stupid. And it's unnecessary. And we talked about it before when, you know, this topic originally came up when Duncan was getting settled in. He was, like, moving into his, like, suite or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. Him and Mineo were, like, having breakfast, or Duncan was having breakfast, and Mineo was just hanging out. And it was a stupid topic then, and it's a stupid topic now. And it comes back to that thing that I don't like about the whole Leto concept and his prescience and him seeing everything in the past and basically drawing conclusions that you sort of have to assume, like, that it is what it is.
Because you assume Mineo was getting this because Leto has told him this is how it is.
Yeah, and even, like, the things that Mineo was pointing out, like, could you theorize some of that stuff? Yeah, maybe, but does it hold up? No, probably not.
Yeah.
You know, under basic scrutiny, it probably doesn't hold up, and the fact that Leto, like, believes it, even though he'd be able to scrutinize the shit out of just about anything, is kind of obnoxious.
Yeah. Agreed.
And on the other hand, with Duncan, like, I'm all for somebody who's having, like, bigoted views getting, like, beat down like he did here. Like, that's cool, but at the same time, it was a weird hill for him to die on and, like, really latch onto, especially, like, in a really future tense book, right? Like, I know this isn't all, like, a universe with sunshine and rainbows. It's not like, you know, Star Trek, we've advanced and, like, we've moved past a lot of things and, like, we're a better society and stuff like that. It's not really that type of a tone. But even still, for this type of a universe, it's, like, a weird hill to die on.
Yeah. It's, like, it'd be fine if Duncan was like, oh, I find this vaguely distasteful.
Mm-hmm.
But he is, like, irrationally angry to be reminded of the existence of homosexuals.
And I think the thing that bothers me the most about it is sort of one thing that bothers me a little bit about the Star Wars sequels, not to dive into a huge rabbit hole here. Okay. But I was listening to a podcast earlier that was talking about this, and it made me think of this. But you know how when you're watching, like, the original trilogy, and you got Luke Skywalker, and you've got Han and Leia, and and Chewie, and they're, like, all, like, really tight-knit, right? And they're all, like, a family, right? And they don't do anything for each other, right? And then when you dive into The Last Jedi, for example, and Rey arrives, right, and is like, the universe is fucked, and Luke just doesn't give a shit. He's just done with everything. And it's just, that's, like, so out of character for him to just be like, I'm fucking done with everything, when you knew Luke as a different person, right? It's sort of a similar thing with Duncan, where you had the first book and even the next two where he's a goal and then he gets awakened and you kind of get to know Duncan as a character and who he is, and, like, he's very loyal to the Atreides and, you know, he's very protective of them and all these other aspects. And then you throw in this weird character trait in this book that he's an awakened Gola now. This is, like, a Duncan gut reaction. It's not just, like, a Gola thing. It's a Duncan thing, right? And it's like, there was this thing there that you didn't know about Duncan, and now it's here, and it's fucking obnoxious.
Well, because that's the thing, is that for most of the rest of his characterization, he might, like, overreact a bit, but you genuinely get the sense that he is on the side of righteousness, or at least as he perceives that. in that he thinks that the shit Leto is doing is heinous and, like, anti-Atreides and against their Atreides values of, like, honor and all of that. Mm-hmm. So he's, like, presented as, like, the, you know, sort of good guy counterpoint to what Leto's doing. But then you make the good guy also this, like, irrational, raging homophobe.
Yeah.
So it makes it harder to root for Duncan to be successful because I'm like, well, you're kind of a dick.
Yeah, and I'm all for having flawed characters, right? Having, like, protagonists that have issues and, you know, even villains that have redeeming qualities. Like, it makes the story more compelling and less black and white. But this is just a weird thing to throw out there. Like, you could throw other things out there to make Duncan a more compelling character and to make him a bit more dynamic than just being, like, a goody two-shoes. Like, nuanced,
but yeah, but...
This is a weird thing to throw out there. And especially, like, with a modern lens, it's definitely an uncomfortable thing for a protagonist to have.
Yeah.
You know?
Honestly, I think all of the stuff around, like, all the discussion around homosexuality in this book makes it feel much more dated.
Yes.
Because it all just feels very, like, this would never be in a book written now, and it doesn't make the book better. Mm-hmm. It makes it worse.
Yeah. How do you feel about this iteration of that issue being thrown in here and being dated compared to the first book with the Baron? How do you think that compares?
Well, it's weird because on the one hand, it's almost like an evolution, and I wonder if it is, in the sense that in the first book, it was, like, unequivocally the only representation of anyone non-straight, as far as we're aware, mm-hmm. was the Baron, who is super evil and gay and a pedophile and, like, just rolling all of those bad stereotypes together. Like, it's not enough for him to just be a bad person. He also has to be a gay pedophile. Mm-hmm. Like, and fat on top of that, because just gotta make, like, him the worst person and, like, conflate all those things together and conflate all of those things. Like, conflate being gay and fat with being, like, effeminate and a homosexual mm-hmm. or and a pedophile and evil. So, yep. Like, that's bad. It was clearly not a positive portrayal of homosexuality. Mm-hmm. This, it seems like, I mean, I think you're supposed to come away from this interaction with that Duncan's being an asshole and that, sure, it's fine. Like, certainly the framing of, like, oh, it's just a phase and they'll grow out of it is not great. Mm-hmm. But, like, compared to Dune, this seems like a positive evolution. Like, I don't think you're supposed to be on Duncan's side here. He's coming off as, like, irrationally angry and, like, a dick yeah. about something. I think you're supposed to be on Mineo's side of, like, what's the big deal? Like, this is just how things are and it's not a problem. Mm-hmm. So that seems like a positive forward movement for Frank Herbert, perhaps. But also because of the, like, oh, it's just a phase and this weird, like, gaze in history thing that just doesn't make a lot of sense. And, like,
yeah.
Weird pop psychology about soldiers that's definitely not a thing, that makes it feel dated.
Yeah.
So, like, it's positive in one sense, but also mm-hmm. I think the book would be better if it just, like, wasn't in it at all. And we just didn't talk about, or maybe it was just, like, a side detail that, like, the fish speakers hook up a lot and we never talked about it beyond that.
Yeah, I don't think it was really necessary to dive into it to this depth.
It's come up so much in this book. It makes yeah. up a significant portion of conversations in this book, and it just doesn't have to.
Yeah, and I think the main thing that's a problem is that in this day and age, and I know this is an older book, so I'm trying not to judge it through a modern lens as much as I can, but part of the problem is reading it today, the aspects of Duncan that we find revolting as a modern society back then would probably have been seen negatively by many readers, but not as negatively as they are seen today. Like, it's a less redeemable, borderline irredeemable quality for someone to have today compared to back then when it would have been significantly more redeemable, I think.
Yeah, people would have been like, oh, yeah, well, he doesn't like gay people, it's normal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Whereas now, I think it's a lot more widespread that you're like, no, you're an asshole.
Yeah, and I say borderline irredeemable just because, like, can you help someone who's in that mindset and make them not in that mindset? Yes, you can. And it's not like he's actively murdering homosexuals or anything yeah. like that, right? So, I mean, I wouldn't call him...
He says we should stamp it out, so I don't know what he's meaning there.
Yeah.
But yes, he's not going around, like, stabbing the fish speakers he sees kissing each other.
Yes, but it doesn't help to make one of your main protagonists have that kind of a mindset
it's
in
like
a book like
deeply
this.
Deeply unpleasant trait that makes it hard to sympathize with him, because any time you're like, oh, good point, you're like, oh, but you're also such a dick.
Yeah, which is also a deeply unnecessary trait to have yeah. because it is so irrelevant to the plot.
And his character, really.
It just doesn't matter. Like, you could I think you could eliminate... You could have the concept that the fish speakers are, you know, hooking up with each other or something, right? And you could make some sort of, like, a... You could draw some sort of a line through the past that maybe some of that stuff happened in armies and stuff because you got young people together and they experimented, right? You could go along that line and just leave it at that, and then the rest of the stuff doesn't matter.
Or even just that Duncan is uncomfortable because it wasn't common back in his day, and it, and he's, like, vaguely uncomfortable about it now, but, like, that's the extent of it.
Mm-hmm. But grand scheme of things, it isn't relevant.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really make a difference. So as a reader, I typically, with this type of thing, just sort of, like, acknowledge it and move on, right? Because it doesn't really matter. And I don't believe it comes up again,
to my knowledge. I thought we were done after that last chapter where it came up, and I was annoyed that we spent a whole chapter on it here. But on the plus side, this chapter had the redeeming qualities of Mineo's savagery. So there's that.
Yes, and at least they did play that with the foil of Mineo, you know, coming back at him and basically telling him, no, you have it wrong, right?
You're an
even if his version of right isn't necessarily
perfect.
Right either, it was at least better than his version of right.
Yeah. All right, I feel like we've expended enough energy on this topic.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to wrap up for the day?
Yep, I think we can do that.
All right.
Till next time, I'm Alex.
I'm Aline.
Thanks for listening. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Pod Emperor of Dune. If you enjoyed listening to us, we'd appreciate a review on your podcasting host of choice, and be sure to let your friends know about us. You can find us on Twitter under the handle NerdIsayMore, or send us an email at nerdisaymore@gmail.com. If you'd like to support us further, please go to patreon.com/nerdisaymore, where you can also get access to exclusive content.